Good afternoon, everyone. Is the mic on?
Yes.
You guys can hear me? Okay, great. Lower? Okay. Higher. Is that better? Okay, great. Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Texas Conference for Women. Hopefully you all are having a great, inspiring day. This session is called Break the Cycle, Embrace Your Hormones. My name is Lisa Macklin. I'm Vice President of Channel Sales at Rackspace, and I will be your MC for today. I'm excited to be here today and thrilled to support the advancement of women in leadership, as well as the advancement in this community. So I get the pleasure of introducing our speaker today. And in fact, we're gonna have two, so we're gonna have a bonus. And we're gonna do this while they're working on the AV. So please help me welcome Marty Hazelton. Marty is a PhD and world's leading researcher in sexuality and ovulation cycle. She's a professor of psychology at the UCLA Institute for Society and Genetics. She's also edited the leading journal in the field Evolution and Human Behavior and directs the Evolutionary Psychology Lab at UCLA. Thank you, Marty, for being here with us today. And I also want to introduce someone else who's going to come up here in about 20 minutes from now. So Marjorie Clifton will be with us today. She is the founder for Better at Work, and she's a principal, founder for Better at Work and principal of Clifton Consulting. She has two decades of experience in communication and policy, and she's also a speaker and media commentator for news such as CNN, Fox, and NBC. And we will be having Marjorie join Marty up here as soon as we can get started. So I'm excited for everyone to be here. Just so you all know, we will have a chance for Q&A after the session. So if you guys want to, you know, note something down or be thinking of something, there will be an open mic for Q&A to follow the session. Are we any closer? Do you want to try, Marty? That's plan B, so we... Yeah.
That's plan B minus, I'm afraid. let's see.
Or would you want to start with the interview?
You can start with the interview if you like, and then the presentation, it's totally...
I don't know if it's going to over... I mean...
Mm-hmm. Or if you want to have your presentation.
I think I can get us started here.
Let's do that.
So let's do that. Okay, so women and hormones. What do we think of when we hear the hormonal woman? Difficult woman? Crazy lady? Bitch on wheels? And then I have a beautiful slide of a woman expressing this sentiment. These stereotypes that spring from the idea that hormones control female behavior are very much alive today. But are they correct? So is it correct that women lose their rational faculties and go nuts when they're hormonal? I don't think so, as you might guess. And I think that the facts in this matter have gotten cherry-picked and then lost in a volatile mixture of sexual politics. It's difficult to untangle myth from reality for those of you who are watching from the sidelines. So let's do some untangling. First, about those stereotypes. It seems that women are doomed to hear about them. Our hormone cycles can cause us to engage in behaviors that vary from day to day in important ways. Yet they are mostly hidden within our bodies. So the hormones that are changing our behaviors or affecting our behaviors, nudging us, are hidden within our bodies. And it's only a small portion of the story that is obvious to us, the things that happen surrounding menstruation, right? So then we have an external indicator of where we are in our cycle, but that's a small sliver of the story. And what's really interesting from my perspective is what is happening in the middle of our cycles when we are most fertile, when we are near ovulation. So these changes that we experience, they seem to sort of come out of nowhere because they're linked to these hidden events within our bodies. And they might make us seem fickle or changeable in some way that is difficult to make sense of. So this is a real obstacle for us as women. We seem unpredictable, perhaps illogical. I think that that is false, and I aim to explain to you how today. So again, about those stereotypes, it seems that we're doomed to hear about them. We change in important ways from day to day. Some of these concern sexuality. And those are some of the things that we've investigated in my lab. Some of the things that change about women, in fact, there's a double whammy. So not only are these changes hidden, linked to hidden changes within our bodies, and therefore they seem somewhat mysterious, but they also go against some stereotypes about the way women should be. It's as if sexuality gets turned on at a certain point within the ovulation cycle, very much going against the way we tend to think of women as being more sexually reserved. And in fact, as you will see, or at least as I will tell you, women become in some ways more male-like in what they desire in a mate, preferring physical attractiveness more on those crucial fertile days of the cycle. Women can also become more assertive, more demanding, and more competitive on those days of the cycle. So these are decidedly anti-feminine behaviors. So is this a double whammy? Not only is it hidden and difficult to understand, but we also are bucking these standard trends in how we think about female behavior when we are subject to these hormonal nudges. So who is this woman? Who is she today? In fact, women's hormone cycles embody a half a billion years. That's 500 million years of evolutionary wisdom. Hormones, so that is spanning back throughout animal species, 500 million years to a common ancestor in which the estrogen receptor, so these are the biochemical receptors that are within our bodies and our brains, became different between males and females. And when that event occurred, these changes that surround ovulation occurred. So what are the consequences of this long period of evolution? Do we all of a sudden go crazy? Of course not. Instead, we become wise. Our hormones evolve to conspire with us, not to work against us, and as we encounter a variety of changes and challenges throughout our lifespans. Think about this in the context in which our ancestral female relatives would have experienced them. The challenges that those females experienced as they chose mates, reproduced, found resources for their offspring, and defended their offspring against others. Hormones are the crucial reason, I argue, the reason that we have survived and thrived. So hormones have a secret intelligence. So how did I come to study this? How did I begin to study these mysterious changes? Let me start with a personal story. I actually got my PhD here at the University of Texas. You were clapping for the University of Texas, of course. Yes, okay, and that is where the story begins. So I was a graduate student. I was doing what graduate students do, studying, working, hanging out with my graduate student colleagues, having some shiner box, and in fact, on a very hot night in Texas. And I was at this party. A good friend of mine showed up, a man, somebody who I had tremendous respect for, really enjoyed having intellectual discussions with him, but I'd never quite noticed him the way I noticed him that night. I think he must have ridden his bicycle to the party because he smelled a little strong. So, and I suddenly, and ordinarily it would have been much too much for me. It was that sort of strong, pine needly, musky scent. But on this occasion, it would have been too much, but on this occasion, I thought it smelled, could it be sexy? Okay, so what's going on here? Why do I suddenly find this person more attractive than usual? Given my training as an evolutionary scientist, I didn't think that it was because my preferences were changing on a whim, that I was the fickle female. Instead, I suspected that there was some evolutionary logic behind it. So, as I like to say, it all started with a stinky t-shirt. Soon after I made that observation, a study would be published, what is now affectionately referred to as the stinky t-shirt study. And in that study, women came into the laboratory, they smelled t-shirts that were contributed by men. These women smelled the t-shirts and rated how attractive they were, rated these men's body scents. And on fertile days of the cycle, so those crucial days of the cycle in which a woman could become pregnant, she rated the man's body odor as more attractive if he was more symmetrical, more bilaterally symmetrical. We are, in principle, bilaterally symmetrical organisms. The two sides of our bodies match. And men, whose the two sides of their bodies matched more, more symmetrical men, were the men that women preferred more, based on this scent cue. Okay, we've got something. Let me see if I can find, there we go. That's the part that's not hidden, this is the part that is hidden. Bucking the female stereotype, hormones have secret intelligence, stinky t-shirts. Okay, so here we are. So women appeared to, in this study, prefer the scents of more symmetrical men. And I wondered, was this part of a more general phenomenon? This is something that looks like what's happening in our non-human animal cousins. Might something like this be happening in humans? So I wanted to investigate, how do women's desires change? How does their sexuality change on these crucial fertile days of the cycle? Okay, so here's what we do. We conduct research in my lab, and in fact, this was research that I initiated when I was here. We collect data from women at two points in their cycle, on a high fertility day of the cycle, just prior to ovulation, which is about here, about midway through the cycle, and then after ovulation, when fertility is low, as menstruation and menstruation would be occurring right here. So we try to avoid those premenstrual days. We do hormone tests to verify that we've captured information about women and their experiences on high versus low fertility days of the cycle. What did we find? We asked women about their attraction to their own partners and to other men. And what women told us was that their attractions changed. If they were partnered with a man who was himself very sexually attractive, they found their own partner more attractive. If they did not, they began to notice other men on these fertile days of the cycle. Okay, and here is how the London Times reported it. Sexy, not sensible, is the trait that fertile women love most in their men. But that really is just an excuse for me to show you how it was reported in a science blog. Study shows that when women say, "It's not you, it's me, it's totally you." So what women appear to prioritize on fertile days of the cycle is male sexual attractiveness. They become a little bit more male-like, is one way to think about it, in their preferences. So this is just a summary. They appear to shop for the sexiest genes in order to pass on those traits to their offspring. I also began to wonder, given that sexuality and mate seeking seems to be turned on more on these fertile days of the cycle, how might women's social behaviors be changing? And might they be observable to others? So even if they are very subtle, And we wouldn't notice them. We wouldn't notice them in the sense of a woman walks into the room and you say, aha, she must be ovulating. But instead that there are subtle cues. And if you observed a woman's behavior every day over the course of a cycle or several cycles, you might notice some differences. What we did was we photographed women as they came to the lab to report on their desires and things that were happening in their relationships. And we just looked at the clothing that they were wearing. Did they wear different kinds of clothing on high versus low fertility days of the cycle? And in fact, they did. Although the changes were subtle, an independent panel of judges who were blind to the fertility status of the women in the photographs chose the high fertility photographs as the ones in which women were dressed more attractively. So here's how the work was reported in the media. That's me. That's Diane Sawyer. That was the first television interview I ever did. A lot of fun, but definitely a little bit nerve-wracking. We also wondered about a very common cue that marks fertility within the cycle across animal species: scent, body odor. So do women's body odors change across the cycle? And so what we did was the armpit study. We collected at least the female version of the armpit study. We collected scents from women at high and low fertility, and we had independent raters come and form judgments of them. And they rated high fertility body odors as being more attractive and less intense. Here's how the New York Times reported that. The fascinating thing about this time, these changes that accompany ovulation, is that they fly under the radar of conscious awareness. So women are affected by ovulation, but we don't have any idea about what, or we have very little idea, some of us might be exceptions, about what's driving changes in our behavior. So this was very tantalizing. Things that are flying under the radar of conscious awareness, but are very much affecting us. Okay, so hormones and other areas of life. There are many. And in fact, I've written an entire book on the hormone changes and the hidden intelligence of hormones, in my view. So there are changes from puberty through to menopause. And I'll just mention a few more. In terms of the ovulation cycle effects, I've mentioned sexuality. There's also some evidence that women are more competitive with other women on fertile days of the cycle, in particular when you put them into a context in which they might be competing for mating opportunities. Women are also more shrewd negotiators with other women in this mating context. In pregnancy, In pregnancy, so there is a reallocation of the ways that our brains think. There is a redistribution of our efforts and our energies away from mundane tasks and toward certain kinds of memory tasks. So I would argue that we should reframe pregnancy brain, and we should reframe a lot of the things that happen during pregnancy, which are often derided as pregnancy fog, as instead something that is actually working in an intelligent way for women. And in the postpartum period, and I'll tell you about a little bit of data here because it's so fascinating. So maternal defense, we've all heard about this with respect to the mama bear effect. So does it characterize humans as well? There is heightened aggression associated with lactation, associated with the onset of breastfeeding across a variety of species. Might this also be true for human females? This is a former postdoc of mine, Jen Han Holbrook, and she did a study to address this. The slide is a little bit off kilter, but you'll get the idea. She collected data from three groups of women: women who were breastfeeding, women who were bottle feeding, so these are two groups of new mothers, and non-mothers. And she was interested in whether they would respond differently to a competitive threat in the lab. So she collected data from them as they walked into the lab at baseline in a conflict situation. So they were actually confronted by an obnoxious female confederate. So the confederate is the accomplice of the experimenter. She was smacking her gum and saying rude things, and then delivering very loud noise blasts. So everybody had on headphones, and the task at hand was to train the subject, so here's the female subject, the unsuspecting female subject, to learn a list of words. And so the Confederate could respond very aggressively by delivering loud noise blasts if she got the answer wrong. And of course, everybody was getting the answers wrong, according to the Confederate, and they were delivering these loud noise blasts. What happened? The question is, how did the female in this, how did this woman who is the subject in the experiment respond? What she did was she delivered, if she was breastfeeding, she delivered louder and longer noise blasts. And that's what this graph shows right here. So the breastfeeding moms were the highest in their what we call retaliatory aggression. It was as if they were mama bears coming to defend their young, or at least in this contrived situation. You can imagine that in the wild, it would be confronting women who were threatening their young. One of the coolest things about this finding is that these women, although they were delivering the loud noise blasts, they were cool as a cucumber. So they were having their blood pressure monitored, all the women in the study, and the lowest blood pressure when delivering the noise blasts in return was in the breastfeeding group. So this is why, one of the reasons why when women breastfeed, they experience a relaxing sensation. So we become fierce as mama bears and we're cool as a cucumber about it. And I remember having this experience. I had twins. I remember having this experience pushing my double stroller down the street and a big dog would be walking toward us. And I would just think to myself, dog, you come between me and these kids and I will break you in half. So I very much felt emboldened and completely calm about it. Okay, so what are the implications of this? So first I'll tell you a little bit about how findings are received amongst academics. Here is a study that was conducted in 2012 during the Obama-Romney election. And what the findings showed was that women who were ovulating, who were in this fertile period within their cycle, their preferences were a little bit more toward Obama, especially if they were single. So they were seeming to cue in to some features of Obama as opposed to Romney. What was the consequence of this? Well, CNN reported the story. And here's what the blogosphere did. CNN thinks crazy ladies vote with their vaginas. Hot for Obama, but only when the smug married is not ovulating. So this is a little bit snide. This is exactly the nightmare of women rampaging through the polls, judging candidates by strength of their chin that has so bedeviled women in the past. CNN actually did what is journalistically unthinkable, and they took the story down. So this was so inflammatory, saying that women's preferences, especially in the voting booth, might be affected by their hormones. So this is fraught territory, saying that a woman is affected by hormones, perhaps because of all of those stereotypes that I've already discussed, is something that is potentially problematic. I think that that is in itself a problem, because we miss out on a lot of potentially important information, not necessarily with respect to this particular study, but more generally. Okay, I'm gonna skip that over. So what's my point? Let me just make one more point about the ovulation and voting study, and that is that men's preferences are also affected by hormones. Men who are higher in testosterone tend to have a more pro-war attitude, okay? But when those findings are published, the blogosphere does not leap to attention and complain that men are going to the polls to vote with their penises. So there seems to be a double standard. Women and hormones, a problem. Men and hormones, not a problem. I think some reframing is in order for a variety of reasons. So what's my point here? I think women are entitled to know everything, and men. We're entitled to know everything about how our bodies operate. And the better we understand our bodies, the better we are able to use them to meet our goals. And I think that hormones have gotten a bad rap because women's hormones get framed in this negative way. And it's up to us to change them and to expose double standards like the penis versus vagina double standard that I just mentioned. So let's break the cycle. How do we do that? The first suggestion that I have is to be a hormone hack. I've told you only a little bit about some of the findings that have come from my lab and have come from elsewhere that show that ovulation has these fascinating effects. How do we use that to our advantage? Use that information so that we can better engineer our daily lives. So let's think about this with respect to mating. Do we experience these hormonal nudges, perhaps noticing somebody other than our romantic partner on those fertile days of the cycle? What do we do? Do we go with it? Do we ignore it? Do we somehow rechannel it into our own bedroom? You can think of a variety of ways in which that might work, or at least I can. Okay, so chocolate cake for breakfast. Sounds great, right? Very attractive person who comes into our view, even though we're in a long-term relationship. Seems, you know, interesting. Might that be the equivalent of chocolate cake for breakfast? Nice idea, but it's not necessarily what I'm going to do. Nice idea. Maybe I'm going to indulge that from time to time. It's up to you. It depends on what it is that you are trying to achieve. And the more you understand what those hormonal nudges are, the better you are able to recognize them when they affect your thinking. And then say to yourself, I'm going to embrace that and I'm going to ride my hormonal waves. Or, I know that that is something that possibly affected my female ancestors and their offspring, their success, but doesn't necessarily meet my needs in the modern world. So I'm going to ignore that. Another example, so that's an example of hormone hacking. Another, in competition. So mating competition is elevated, at least the evidence in hand suggests that on balance. How can we rechannel that in our daily lives? If we recognize that we have those competitive urges, if we know that we might be more shrewd negotiators, depending on where we are in our cycle, then we can make the most of it. Notice that when it happens and channel it toward meeting our goals. In parenting, can we channel the mama bear? Probably the best public presentations I've ever given were soon after my babies were born. I was up to the challenge, and I felt cool as a cucumber. Okay, reframe and change. This, I think, is a really fascinating issue. So there is a pink tax. Have any of you heard of the so-called pink tax? Toys that are made out of pink are more expensive than toys. The same scooter made out of pink is more expensive than the same scooter made out of blue plastic. Gloria Steinem highlighted a version of the pink tax in an essay that she wrote in the 1980s called If Men Could Menstruate. And there are several things that I love about that title. She argued that if men were the ones who got menstrual periods, periods would become a source of masculine pride. Sanitary, and this is a quote, sanitary supplies would be federally funded and free. And, hilariously, of course, some men would still pay for the prestige of such commercial brands as Paul Newman tampons, Muhammad Ali's rope-a-dope pads, John Wayne's maxi pads, and Joe Namath jock shields for those light bachelor days. So is that true? Is there a double standard? And what are the implications? So would it be, in this way of reimagining, if men could menstruate, would things be different? Possibly they would. And what I'm suggesting is that one of the things that we do with these findings is we reframe them. We reframe them in an empowering way to women and say, yes, of course, we're hormonal. And they have all of these fascinating effects. They don't make us crazy or irrational. Instead, they do all of these very important things for us. I also think that we should ask for more. So here are just a few interesting facts. Age and fertility. So fertility varies across the lifespan for women, as you well know. But those statistics are mostly based on research that was conducted over 100 years ago. Okay, that's not the modern context in which we are becoming pregnant. And so no wonder we have baby panic. No wonder if women are being told that fertility steeply declines soon after their 30th birthday and baby panic ensues. And that's not correct, because it's based on these ancient statistics. We need to demand more. We know very little about the psychological effects of the pill. We know that the pill has minimal effects on things like reproductive cancers, and that's been very much something that drug companies have been interested in assessing when they are developing contraceptive pills, which have been truly revolutionary for women since they were invented in the 1950s. But what about the psychological consequences? We are fundamentally altering the hormones that would otherwise change our behaviors across the cycle. So estrogen and progesterone that change across our cycles. Estrogen highest on fertile days of the cycle. Progesterone rising as we near menstrual onset. We are fundamentally changing those when we take a daily pill that contains estrogen and progesterone in varying doses depending on the pill formulation. What are the implications of that, given that we know that it affects our mate preferences and our competitive behaviors? Those are just a few of the things that I told you about today. And hormone therapy is still very poorly understood. Very common question that I get, what about hormone therapy? Should I do it? Should I not do it? I can't give a firm answer to that question. One thing I can tell you is that hormone therapy early in menopause has less risk than hormone therapy later in menopause. One thing I can't tell you, however, is how might different hormone therapy formulations affect you? And what is it? And so that is an important question depending on what it is that you are trying to achieve. So are you trying to achieve a better sex life, rekindle an old flame perhaps? Are you trying to minimize some of the effects of the onset of menopause, hot flashes and so forth? And depending on what it is that you're trying to achieve, you might opt for a different hormone cocktail. But this is not the way that doctors and not the way that drug companies are really thinking about hormone replacement therapy. They're thinking about the physiological effects in the same way that the pill formulation companies have been thinking about the physiological effects. But what about the psychological effects? I think we really need to demand more information. There's in general a dearth of information about females because males tend to be treated in biomedical research as the default because females, whether you're thinking about rats or humans, are messy. We have hormone cycles. And if you think about the sort of ideal of the carefully controlled experiment in which everything is the same except for whatever the crucial variable is that the researcher wants to understand, messy hormone cycles is not what you want to include. And so we've tended to look at males and assume that they can be the default, but we know that that's not true. So very famously, we know that's not true for our understanding of heart disease. I think it's likely to be untrue for a wide variety of things. Yes. Okay, thank you. And so let me give you an example of this. We have, for bedroom troubles, we have Viagra for guys. Within an hour of wanting to have sex, pop the little blue pill and increase the all-important blood flow to the penis. We have, instead of Viagra, we have the very sexy-sounding flibanserin for females. You have to take it every day. It can make you dizzy and feel like you're going to pass out. And you can't drink alcohol, so much for champagne and candles to enhance the experience, that evening's experience. So we lack a complete understanding of a variety of things, and I really think that we need to ask for more. The fact that we have this real inequality in understanding and enabling an enhancement of sexual functioning for men and women is potentially a symptom of that. Although female desire might be a little bit more difficult problem to solve than blood flow. Okay, there are new NIH, National Institutes of Health, guidelines that require there to be parity, equal numbers of males and females represented in studies, whether you're looking at the cellular level and on forward. So that is good news. The pill. So how might the pill affect our mating relationships? This is a question that I often get from my undergraduate students. The answer is, it probably depends. Different pill formulations operate in different ways. They have different mechanisms of action. Some of them administer a steady dose of estrogen across the cycle. And that's going to be more like the kind of hormone cocktail that should turn on sexuality in the ways that I described. Whereas other hormone, other pill formulations have more progesterone, and they're going to be, they're going to have different psychological effects. And they actually might have some effects that make you more interested in your long-term mate. So these are the kinds of things I can imagine a conversation that a woman might have at some point in the future with her doctor, not just about the symptoms that she experiences as a consequence of taking hormonal contraceptives and whether she can tolerate those pills more easily than others, but also what kinds of psychological consequences they might have for her and empowering her to make better decisions depending on what her goals are. And so that is it. I am suggesting that we reframe the debate that indeed we are hormonal. I am hormonal, and I am proud to be hormonal. And I hope that you are all proud to be hormonal as well. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to watch time? Because we only have about 8 minutes. All right, we're going to do some questions.
Oh, we have
and I'm going to kick off
time.
Some questions. Yeah, we'll make it really short, and I'll help facilitate. Actually, I'm going to start. Gosh, I feel like we need a day to talk about hormones. And I think that one of the things that you pointed out that's really interesting is our discomfort with talking about them. Mm-hmm. There isn't a lot of spaces where women feel like it's safe to talk about because there's a negative connotation to being hormonal, right? So just from a practical sense, I mean, and it sounds like in the way you concluded that legitimately women's decision-making and behaviors change based on the cycle of their hormones.
Yes.
And that's what science says.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, there's not a one-to-one correspondence between experiencing a hormone change and our behavior. So there's,
right.
There are hormonal nudges, and we might feel a little bit differently, but that doesn't mean that we necessarily eat chocolate cake for breakfast, to use that as an example.
No, but let me ask this. So there are women, you know, this friend of mine who might plan her calendar around hormonal waves because on certain days having emotional conversations with a spouse or child might not be the best decision.
Okay.
Is that a legitimate, is that crazy or is that a smart thing to do for us to sort of be thoughtful about how our hormonal waves work?
Absolutely. I think that that's not crazy at all. And so there's a lot of variation between women. Different women have different kinds of experiences. Some women, for example, you might be talking about PMS.
Yes. My friend, yes, she said that it's about that. Yeah.
So some women experience those symptoms and some women do not. And one thing that I encourage women to do is to track their own cycles and to notice, you know, are there times in which maybe that very delicate conversation is not the one that I want to have, or maybe that's the time that I do want to have that very delicate conversation because I'm going to stand up for it. You know, it's not that I've suddenly become irrational. That might be the one point within my cycle in which I am rational. Yeah, I'm mad. There's something to be mad about here. And I'm going to quash that usual conflict avoidance female stereotype. This is what the way a psychotherapist friend of mine put it. And be this emboldened person instead.
Okay, so the other interesting question I had for you was, do hormones correlate with sex drive in men versus women? And meaning, they say men, you know, that women are more the ones that hold the men off and men are the ones with the stronger drive. Is there truth to that?
So there is a sex difference. Men are more open to casual sex than women are. Newsflash. And that's true cross-culturally. So there is a sex difference. But there are these hormonal changes as well. Mm-hmm. So for women, there are changes across a month. For men, there are varying levels of baseline testosterone, so the amount of testosterone that you're walking around that characterizes your body on a typical day. But there are also, people talk about women being hormonal. Men are hormonal too. They don't have monthly cycles, but they have cycles that are every day. Testosterone peaks early in the morning, which is why you might have noticed that telltale sign if you co-sleep with another man, telltale sign in the morning that lets you know that testosterone is higher at that point than another. And so men are hormonal too, and men's hormones are associated with their interest in sex as well.
And I have one other question for you, and then I'm going to turn it over because I know you guys haven't gotten Q&A time that you wanted. And that was around pregnancy brain.
Mm-hmm.
Because you talked about that, you know, the same facilities are there, it's just wired differently. What
right.
is that difference?
So there are a variety of things that change. So one thing that happens during... as women are moving through pregnancy is that we suddenly feel like we need to engage in some what we might think of as nesting behaviors. And that sounds crazy. That sounds like something that is a stereotype. But in fact, it makes a lot of sense. And it made a lot of sense for our ancestors, where the environment was much more perilous. We had to make sure that the resources and the environment in which we were going to raise that very vulnerable infant was going to be just right. So that's one way. Another way is the ways that, so we tend to think of women as being better at managing multiple tasks. There's actually some legitimacy to that, that we can do more than one thing at once. Nothing comes for free. There are always trade-offs. And so there might be some things that we are better able to remember. Better able to remember things that are affecting us at work and things that are affecting our home life and be able to juggle those things. But that might come at the cost of remembering, for example, another person's name.
Well, and Stephen Covey even talks about this as he trains workforces on the physiological and hormonal differences between men and women and how we deal with stress in a work environment. Mm. And our hormones actually correlate to that memory you talk about where mm-hmm. they say with a guy, you know, if when your wife is ticked off, how she can remember like an example to like 1995 and that exact moment when you did that exact thing like it. And it's that our hormones allow us to access all of this memory highway in our brains, whereas guys, when they have that increased stress response, they do legitimately single track for a reason, which is their physiological design is remove stimulus, attack problem, and then basically lower the adrenaline rate. So it was really interesting. So if you he's got a book, it's Mars and Venus in the Workplace, and it's a really interesting book because it talks about hormones. And I think that's a hard thing in the workplace, that when we talk about all of these different conversations about men and women dynamics, is not acknowledging like the legitimate physiological hormonal differences and how it does impact the way we process information and we
absolutely
respond
and
to
it's
things.
not necessarily something that is an impediment.
No.
Instead, it is something that we can embrace and celebrate. So we can kind of think about it more in the Gloria Steinem way than in this other way, and make the workplace in general. Better for both moms and dads. So make, breastfeeding has all of these favorable effects for it's not the only way, certainly, but it has a lot of favorable effects both for offspring and for their mothers. So let's make it easier for women to do. It's not going to impair their productivity, but could perhaps enhance it.
And if people have questions, feel free to line up at the mic and we'll take them. And I will say there's a guy that I know, no questions? Oh, come on, ladies. You can't be sitting here hearing this presentation with no questions whatsoever. You can pass them on a piece of paper. I'll read them. It's fine. But there's a guy that I know who's doing, he and his wife are starting to do trainings on menopause and what happens to women's bodies, because it's like, it's a household activity. I mean, it's like, I remember going through this vividly with my mother and us like falling around with bags of like soy powder or whatever we could come up with to help her through it. And anyway. You have a question? Great. We'll take a question.
So you talked a lot about what happens during ovulation. I'm curious about PMS and what happens to our hormones during that time and how we can lean into that?
Yes, okay. So just prior to menstrual onset, progesterone's going way up. Progesterone has a variety of effects, but some of them are pro-social. They make us feel sort of like getting around other people and being friendlier with other people. But right before menstrual onset, progesterone dives down. And one way of thinking about PMS is that it's progesterone withdrawal. And that could affect how we are interacting with others. So we're feeling warm and fuzzy, and then all of a sudden we're going through this a bit of a different change, and it's a pretty dramatic shift. We also might feel differently about our mates, in particular. And one of my evolutionary scientist colleagues actually has developed a hypothesis, which is, so we, you know, move through our hormone cycles, sometimes we become pregnant, most of the time we do not. This is a very strange evolutionary event. Having sex, not having babies. Having sex, not having babies. Our bodies must be thinking, well, what's going on here? You know, might my mate be infertile? And therefore, you know, menstrual onset's coming, get rid of the boyfriend. I think that that's a little bit much, but I think it's a very interesting idea, and it's an idea that comes from really reframing how we're thinking about hormones.
Okay, real quick, we have one last question, and then we'll wrap up. Okay.
I'm curious what, when you say hormones, like, what do those include?
Yes.
Because I was thinking a lot when you were talking, I'm a birth doula, and oxytocin is, we need that to make a baby just as much as we need it to have a baby.
Right.
And it's almost more accepted in that capacity from a cultural perspective.
Right.
That it's okay for oxytocin to flow because you need to have your baby, but not so much in a sexual sense.
Right.
So is that included when you're referring to hormones?
Or? It is. It's not a hormone that varies across the cycle, and so it hasn't been something that we've been intensely focused on in my lab. Oxytocin also has the, which is partly erroneous, has the reputation of being the cuddling hormone, so it all sounds very nice, you know, whereas estrogen and progesterone have all of these other kinds of effects, sexuality effects, progesterone withdrawal and PMS. Having some potentially negative effects, or at least one way of thinking about them is a negative way. So the story, as it gets filtered to us as consumers of researchers, when it comes to oxytocin, is one that seems uncontroversial. Whereas when we're thinking about these other reproductive hormones that vary across the cycle, we run into the more perilous territory. But I'm thinking about all of those things.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, check out her research if you have any other questions or information. And thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
Yes, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
And you guys enjoy the rest of your day.